Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammerness, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We are here today to discuss Wisconsin Bell Incorporated versus United States ex rel Heath, which was decided by the court in a 9-0 decision on February 21st, 2025. It is my honor to introduce our guest today, John Maslon. John is counsel at Keller Postman LLC, where he works on a broad range of disputes, including products liability and consumer protection suits. And with that, I'll hand things over to John to discuss how the case got to the Supreme Court.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here today. This case has a bit of an interesting history in that the plaintiff, Todd Heath, has a very odd view of the lowest corresponding price regulation under the E-rate program. And the E-rate program is a program that allows schools to receive reduced price telecommunications services. For the past 15 years, Heath has been arguing that companies like Wisconsin Bell have been misinterpreting this lowest price requirement that's in the code of federal regulations implementing the statute, and has been pushing government regulators to adopt his interpretation. Unable to do so, he filed this QI-TAM suit, which means he sued Wisconsin Bell on behalf of the United States, arguing that they are violating the False Claims Act with how they are charging schools. And then the Seventh Circuit said that his case could go forward because the United States provided some of the money for the E-rate program. This apparently split from the Fifth Circuit decision years before, and so the Supreme Court granted certiorari to resolve that circuit split.
Right. And I guess now, since we've kind of gotten the background of how it got to the court, can you take us just a quick, you know, minute or two of the oral arguments, kind of what the arguments were for both sides?
Sure. So the main argument that the petitioner, Wisconsin Bell, made was that the purpose of the False Claims Act is to prevent the United States from losing money, to prevent the federal fisc from being the victim of fraud. And here, all the Wisconsin Bell argued, at least, all the funds were provided by private parties. So the private telecommunications carriers were paying a private corporation called USAC, the Universal Service Administration Corporation. And so they said it was private companies giving money to private companies, no federal fisc involvement, and so therefore it didn't fall under the ambit of the False Claims Act. The petitioners, the respondents had three arguments in response. They first argued that because federal law requires the telecommunications providers to pay the administrative corporation a certain percentage of their revenue each year, that was sufficient because the government was forcing this transfer to happen, that satisfied the providing language within the False Claims Act. The second argument was that the Treasury actually provided some funds to the Universal Service Administration Corporation, and so therefore that was a second way that funds were provided. And finally, the respondents argued that even if that wasn't the case, that USAC was an agent of the United States, so any claims presented to USAC could fall under the ambit of the False Claims Act.
Right. And so, as I mentioned in the intro, the case ended up being a 9-0 decision with Justice Kagan writing the opinion for the court. Can you take us through her opinion?
Sure. It's a pretty straightforward opinion. As I mentioned, the respondents argued that Wisconsin Bell's activities were covered by the False Claims Act for three reasons. Justice Kagan decided that, well, instead of reaching the two harder questions, that she would go straight to the second argument that the respondents made, and that was that the United States Treasury had paid into the Universal Services Administration Corporation. So over the course of time, I think that it was about $10 billion that USAC collected, and of that, $100 million was from the United States Treasury. And the way the Treasury received those funds were typically is a telecommunications provider would not comply with the law and would not pay their fee that they owed the USAC. And so DOJ would sue them, recover the money, and then once, you know, a judgment is entered ordering you to pay the United States government a sum certain, that money is then deposited into the Treasury. And then from the Treasury, the money was transferred to USAC. And what Justice Kagan said was, this is still providing. And that even if the original source of the money was the private telecommunications companies, that the United States federal government provided it to USAC. And she used the example of an exam blue book. She said there, the proctor of an exam is providing students with the blue books when she hands them out, even if the school or somebody else actually had the money and paid for the blue books, it was still the proctor also provided the books. And so she just looked at the dictionary definition of provided, what the ordinary meaning of the word was, and determined that yes, the United States is providing of this United States' transfer of this $100 million constituted providing. And because under the False Claims Act, the United States doesn't have to provide the entire amount, it only is required to provide a portion, that was sufficient, she said, to mean that these activities were covered by the False Claims Act. Now, she was very careful to say that in one issue at oral argument was, well, if the United States only provided, let's say, 1% of the money for USAC during this time period, what damages would be available to the plaintiff in an action like this? And she said, that's a question for a different day. We're not going to address that. We are going to just say that at least because the government provided some of the money, it's covered by the False Claims Act, and litigation regarding potential recovery could happen if Wisconsin Bell is found liable under the False Claims Act.
And that does seem quite straightforward, but there are two concurring opinions, one written by Justice Thomas and then one written by Justice Kavanaugh, if I'm not mistaken. Can you take us through Justice Thomas's concurrence? Because I know he doesn't talk about the question that Justice Kagan talked about, but he talks about the implications of the government's arguments if they were accepted.
Yeah, so like I said, there were, again, the respondents and the government kind of had three arguments. And Justice Kagan hopped on the second one and said because of that, the funds were provided. Justice Thomas instead looks at the first and third arguments, and he says he kind of explains what the flaws in those arguments that he sees. So let's start with the first argument, which is saying that because the government required private corporations to transfer money to another private corporation, that therefore that suffices under the False Claims Act. Well, Justice Thomas used the analogy of a simple lawsuit. And so say two private parties are suing each other and they're a United States district court enters judgment for one of those parties and says, you lose, defendant, you have to pay the plaintiff $10 million. Well, under the government's theory, Justice Thomas says, that transfer of $10 million, because the federal court is requiring that transfer, could be seen as, you know, providing money, that the United States is providing money to the plaintiff. And he says that raises serious issues, both under the text of the statute and under the Constitution. He then moves on to the third argument that the respondent and the government made, which was that USAC was an agent of the United States. And he says this would run into statutory problems because there's a federal statute that bars the United States agencies from creating corporations without express congressional approval. So, for example, actually, when USAC was created, there was the FCC tried to create a private corporation that was a subsidiary of the FCC. And in the end, Congress said, you can't do that because it violates the Government Corporate Control Act, and therefore you must have this as an independent corporation. And that's kind of how USAC is now situated.
Great. And then Justice Kavanaugh had maybe one of the shortest concurrences I've ever seen. It was, you know, maybe 10 lines, if that. Can you just quickly talk about that?
I actually think this might end up being one of the most important parts of the decision. And that's because this is a rehash of his concurrence from Polanski, which is another recent False Claims Act case, where he raised the same issue. And Justice Kavanaugh believes that the key TAM provisions of the False Claims Act might be unconstitutional. So he raised that issue in Polanski. There he was joined by Justice Barrett. Justice Barrett does not join his concurrence here, which is very interesting. And don't know really what to make of that, whether she's reconsidered her position or she just decided she didn't need to join it this time because she joined it in Polanski. And then Justice Thomas joined it as well here. He didn't join in Polanski because he dissented in that case, but it looks like there's at least two, possibly three votes to grant cert on the question of whether the False Claims Act's key TAM provision is constitutional. And we're seeing a lot of litigation on that issue in the lower federal courts right now. A lot of companies that are being sued by relators under the False Claims Act are raising the constitutional question and are trying to get that case up the SCOTUS as soon as possible.
Can you explain a little bit more about the key TAM provision that Justice Kavanaugh has raised in multiple opinions?
Sure. So the United States actually doesn't file most False Claims Act cases. Instead, they rely on relators who are just ordinary citizens normally, who will file suit and say, hey, I know that this corporation is filing false claims with the government, they're committing fraud, and therefore, United States, you should be able to recover some of the money that they have been stealing from you. And what the key TAM provision says is that once you file that suit, the United States has a decision. They can either take over the case and say, oh yeah, we agree with you, we want to come in. Or they could say that, you know what, we don't have the resources to do so. And so you can continue litigating that case. And then if the relator, and that's the person that sues on behalf of the United States, wins, they get to keep a sizable percentage of any recovery from the defendant. So there is a large bar now who kind of focuses on these types of cases, who they will sue companies who are committing fraud against the United States and then recover damages for that. And the constitutional question is whether this violates Article 2. because they are suing to enforce public rights, and they are not officers of the United States. There is no oversight by the Attorney General once, you know, a relator sues and is permitted to proceed on their own behalf. So some believe that this violates Article 2 to allow relators to sue on behalf of the United States.
Okay. So I guess let's quickly turn to some of the consequences that come from this decision. I know you mentioned how Justice Kavanaugh is kind of signaling that he wants the constitutional question to come up, and you mentioned that it may come up. Do you see that being the biggest consequence of a decision like this, or more so just in the actual statute and how it's used?
Well, I think there's a few potential consequences. One, I do think that Justice Kavanaugh is continuing pounding the drum on the constitutional question means at some point in the near future, the court is going to have to consider the question. As far as the broader implications on the statute, one thing to note is the court has another case this term called FCC v. Consumers Research, which it considers whether this universal service fund setup is constitutional or whether it violates the non-delegation doctrine. And the overall impact of this case will probably depend on the decision in that case, because if the court holds that, you know, this whole structure is unconstitutional, then the impact of Wisconsin Bell is going to be much smaller. And that's one reason that the court's ruling here is so limited and so narrow, is they kind of had that in the back of their mind. And as far as the other big potential impact is on damages, and seeing how narrow the court's decision is here, to see whether we defendants moving forward are going to argue for reduced damages when the government doesn't provide 100% of the funding for a program.
Right. Well, I think that that was a great overview of the case from kind of beginning to end here. Thank you so much for joining us, John.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers. Founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental power is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.